Hey, my name is John. I served 24 years for a crime I didn't commit. It's a lot of issues I don't think a whole lot of people know about as far as us, until my husband's honoree. They don't know what being in that traumatic situation, being in that situation, have done to us.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the stories of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Listen to the heartbreaking true accounts of wrongfully convicted people and their journey to exoneration. Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to listen all the way through the end of this episode to get more information on some upcoming plans. One of my sponsors has really helped me lately understand how good science turns into the junk science that gets people wrongly convicted. And that is the Great Courses Plus. I firmly believe that we continue to learn through our entire lives, not just through school, but through a variety of mediums. That's why I love the Great Courses Plus and their engaging video lectures presented by award-winning professors. With the Great Courses Plus, we have unlimited access to so many lectures that offer a wealth of knowledge so we can learn about all of our interests on our own time schedule because they can be streamed at any time on any device. You can choose from so many topics like history, civil rights, or even cooking and photography. I want you to sign up for the free trial so you can start watching the Great Courses right away, like the one I just watched called Forensic History, Crimes, Frauds, and Scandals. It's exactly the insight you need to better understand how people get wrongly convicted on faulty science. It has all these insights into what happens when forensics go wrong, like when thousands of innocent people were sent to prison based on one scientist's lies. It's helped me to understand the motives and process through which good scientists can present junk science and affect real people's lives. You're definitely going to want to sign up for the Great Courses Plus. Luckily, right now, as one of my listeners, you can sign up for the Great Courses Plus and get a free month of unlimited access to all their lectures. Start your free month by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/actual. So again, remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/actual. Thanks for joining me for episode 18 of Actual Innocence. John White spent 20 years incarcerated for a crime he did not commit, but later became one of the first people exonerated by DNA evidence in Georgia. While John admits he was not a choir boy in his youth, he had nothing but respect for women and could not have committed this rape that he was convicted of. I am Brooke, and this is John's story.
I was 19 years old. My grandma raised me, and I was raised around, I got six sisters, and I was raised to really respect women. My grandma, you know, she took me everywhere she went, and pretty much raised, you know, in the church. My grandma worked as a maid, you know, housekeeping when I was younger, and I used to be with her mostly everywhere she went. I got up to about, when I turned maybe about 16, you know, I started experiencing life beyond my grandmother. And I feel like I kind of got away from that Christian atmosphere that my life was sort of headed in when I was, you know, with my grandmama and, you know, doing things, you know, in a manner that was, you know, pleasing and in her sight and God. That's when it was so hard when I was accused of rape and all those other offenses they had in that charge, because I never had a problem with, you know, in my teenage years, I never had a problem with females. I never had a problem dating. And, you know, to be accused of, you know, something like that, it was hard.
In the early morning hours of August 11, 1979, someone broke into the home of a 74-year-old woman in Manchester, Georgia. The woman was raped and beaten and robbed. The man yanked the phone cord out of the wall as he left. After the attack, the victim was taken to a hospital to be treated. But due to the severity of her injuries, no rape kit was collected. I asked John if he could tell me what he was doing on that day.
I really can't say definitely what I was doing that day, other than, you know, I was maybe hanging out with, you know, with my cousins or something like that, you know, because I just don't know. All I know that I heard about it in the street. I heard about some people that it may have done it. And that was it. And, you know, like I said earlier, once I started experiencing the life beyond my grandmother, you know, I wasn't no choir boy. You know, I was out there, you know, I was doing little things. And like I said, I heard it in the street. So later on, you know, I committed a burglary. And I left Manchester and went to the place where I have some cousins, Decatur, Georgia. And I went there. And I got caught up in Decatur, Georgia. And when they were transporting me back to Manchester on the burglary charge, they were also asking me about this here rape of a 70-something-year-old white female. And I told them, I didn't answer the question directly. You know, I told them if I had done it, the lady would have had gonorrhea, because during the time when the lady had got raped, I had gonorrhea. And they took that and ran with it. When they got me to the county jail, they booked me in and they started questioning me about the rape.
I wondered what information the police might have had to start investigating John for this crime.
I don't have no idea. All I know that the detectives from Meadowood County, when they, you know, like I said, when they picked me up in the court, you know, they just asked me about, you know, started questioning me about the charge. And like I said, when we got back to Meadowood County, I was expecting to get out on bond. You know, I knew my grandma was going to come get me out. And my grandma came up the next day to get me out. They told her that I wouldn't be released because I was being charged with those other crimes.
I asked John if he had been interrogated by the police or if they had tried to coerce him in any way.
No, they questioned me about it. They took some hair samples, blood samples, fingerprints, and saliva samples. And that was that. That was basically it. I wasn't questioned too much more after then, other than they did a lineup. And the actual guy that did the crime was in the same lineup. Matter of fact, I was standing in one spot. Another person was in between us.
The 74-year-old white woman picked John out of the lineup, stating, "I'm almost positive that was him." A recent study shows a definite statistically significant cross-race impairment, where members of any race have a clear deficiency for accurately identifying members of another race. This appears to be true regardless of the races in question.
I didn't ask for one. My mother hired an attorney, a guy named Sanford Bishop out of Columbus, Georgia. At that time, Mr. Bishop was a state representative. He was doing criminal defense and, you know, serving on the state legislature. So we hired him. I think that if he had been a little bit more pushy, a little bit more, like I said, the Georgia General Assembly was going on at the time that my trial started. And I don't think he applied himself enough.
John went on to tell me about the trial.
It was It was mostly the state introducing the evidence. They questioned her on the stand. She told what happened. The he
John is referring to is his attorney.
He questioned her about her eyesight because she was nearsighted or farsighted, and you know the lighting in the house wasn't that great. He questioned the crime lab investigators about the evidence that they looked at, and it really was just a quick trial. You know, it was a quick trial. It was maybe lasted 4 or 5 hours.
4 or 5 hours was the length of a trial to determine the outcome of a man's life. I asked him if he remembered how long the jury deliberated.
They took me down to a holding cell, and maybe about 30 minutes to an hour later, they brought me back up. They tried me for the rape and all the other charges they had in it. And they found me guilty on all of it, and they gave me life in 40. I do know that during the course of the trial, all the evidence they had collected, everything that came through the crime lab came back negative, except for the hair sample. And my lawyer, he got up and he disputed what the crime lab investigator was saying, like, you know, the pigmentation of the hair could, you know, it could match anybody. You know, in the black race. And he talked about that. And like I said, the fingerprint, they took the fingerprints off maybe about 3 or 4 surfaces, but when it came to trial, they said the fingerprints was all smudged and they couldn't take. They found a piece of skin at the later house and it didn't match mine. The blood didn't match. They said that the crime lab investigator said the hair sample could be mine.
I wanted to clarify that could be mine meant that it was possible, but not a definite fact.
No, it wasn't definite. It wasn't definite. You know, I really, for the trial, you know, all that came back with a guilty verdict, I really thought I was going home.
19 years old and having hoped that justice would prevail, and then receiving the ultimate disappointment. I couldn't imagine how John felt.
I really can't say how I felt. I was stunned. I was stunned because I deeply believed that at the end of that trial I was gonna go home. I was so confident that I was gonna go home. Before I went to trial, I had the opportunity to leave the county jail, and I left, and I came back and turned myself in.
I asked about the reaction of his family to the guilty verdict.
My grandma was ill at the time. The trial went on, but she wasn't at the trial. Wasn't nobody at the trial. My mom and a couple of my sisters. I know that I was told that my mom started crying because she heard one of the jurors. She said that one of the jurors was crying after the trial and said they had just sent an innocent man to jail. But you know, I believe that one day God will open those doors for me. You know, I when they gave me their life in 60, I took it in stride, you know, and I just believe that God will open the door for me one day.
Then I asked about his life in prison.
It was just something that I just got into. When I first went to Jackson Diagnostic, you know, so I had my troubles. You know, because I was a young kid and I wasn't used to, you know, I was used to having my way. I basically spoiled because my grandma raised. And I was the only boy out of 7 kids. And like I said, I had my troubles, but I adjusted. I knew what I looked at the situation and I felt like it was certain things I had to do to make living inside the penitentiary easy. I accepted that authority. You know, I took some things I didn't want to take from them, but I knew that in order to, you know, make it easy, that's what I was going to have to do.
I wanted to know how his relationships were affected by being in prison.
It separated us, you know, physically. But my mom kept our family bond together, you know. She was that person that, like, at Christmas, you know, she made sure that, you know, I provided for her. Every month, she made sure that, you know, she was on a fixed income. But she made sure that, you know, I provided for her, if it wasn't but a little bit. You know, and we kept in touch. I went to penitentiary with Georgia Department of Rehabilitation. And that they had programs inside that, you know, if you wanted to, you know, if you wanted to participate in them, you could get an education, you can get a craft, you could get a trade. I participated. I got my GED. I went on and got a few hours in a college program they had. I got some vocational training. You know, that's some of the things I achieved.
I told John that I had read somewhere that he had never filed an appeal because he wasn't aware that it was his right to do so.
Well, when I first got into penitentiary, about the chain gang lawyers and all this type of stuff.
John is referring to other inmates who had been studying law in prison.
I filed ineffective system of counseling, got denied. Like I said, I didn't know anything about the other thing. I was basically going on chain gang attorney. But what really read my, I had wrote the Innocent Prizes in New York. I hadn't heard from them. I pretty much had given up. I had just been turned down for parole, and I was told I wouldn't be coming back for parole in my 10 years.
I asked John if being paroled would have meant confessing to a crime that he didn't commit.
Well, I was at one point when I came up for parole, I went before the parole board, and they told me that that was one of the things I was going to have to do. I was going to have to get in some type of sex offender program. And in that sex offender program, you're going to have to admit to the offense. And you're going to have to write. They would ask me to write a couple paragraphs or something like that there, admitting to the crime and telling what took place during the course of the crime. I didn't do it. I couldn't. And I was denied entrance into the group. It was really amazing, but I was thinking it was a divine intervention of God, because it couldn't have been, because man, back then they told me I wasn't going to get out of penitentiary unless I participated in the old course. And during that time, I was incarcerated. Things happened in a way that I don't know how they happened. I was sent to an institution that had the program, because the institution I was at didn't have it. I was sent there. I was denied entry into the group. I was called to the warden's office and asked why was I at his institution. And a few weeks later, I was sent to a halfway house. And it was just something that happened.
I haven't spoken with any other exonerees who told me that they spent time in a halfway house. So I asked John if he could give me some more details about that.
It's a training. It's a great program for a guy that's been in the penitentiary, I'd say 10 years or more. It helps them get back into society.
I asked John how he had come to get involved with the Georgia Innocence Project.
I was working on my, say, about the 20-something year, and I got a letter from them. They were just starting the organization. And I got a letter from them. And I looked at it, and I'm like, I'm thinking, what could they do? I done tried everything it was, you know, in my power to get out. And I just put the letter in with my legal papers. And didn't think nothing else of it. And I had got in some trouble. I was smoking marijuana, and I was in isolation, and it's just like a voice came to me and told me to read that that again and write those people. And at that moment, I felt I knew instantly who to write. So I went through my legal papers and I got the letter and I wrote them. I heard back from them immediately, maybe a week or so. They went through their little process of accepting my case, you know, and they went to Meriwether County. I guess they requested evidence that was in my trial. I know that he was told that everything had been destroyed. I know, and so that they went for the all the other records that they could find. And they entered the hair samples in the evidence when I went to trial on a slide. And when everything was over with, instead of them putting the slides, I'm just assuming that, instead of they putting the slides back among the other evidence, they put it in a folder along with the paper evidence. And they found those slides that had the hair samples and all on it.
Speaking of letters, we need to take a break for a minute to talk about our other amazing sponsor, Stamps.com. I live in an apartment, and today, while I was at work, a package too big to fit in my little mailbox came from the post office. They left me a little slip saying I would need to go to the post office to get it. When I went to the post office after work, it was closed. How great would it be if the post office was open 24/7, with no more limited hours? You could get mailing and shipping done on your schedule. Well, now you can when you use Stamps.com. You can print whatever postage you need right from your desk when you need it. Stamps.com will save you the time and hassle of going to the post office and trying to make it there during business hours or wasting your lunch break. You just use your printer and computer to get official U.S. postage for any letter or package and then give it to the mailman to pick up. You can save money with Stamps.com, too. Get exact postage the instant you need it, and you won't ever overpay. You even can get special postage discounts you can't get at the post office. I use Stamps.com all the time to send out thank you cards to my Patreon sponsors, care packages to fellow podcasters, and I hope a few of you out there are going to get it and use it to send me a potato for my birthday, like I mentioned on Twitter. To make things easier for you, you can get a special offer right now if you sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code, ACTUAL. It's a 4-week free trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So, don't wait. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone on the top of the homepage and type in ACTUAL. That's Stamps.com. Enter the word ACTUAL. John had been told that the evidence in his trial was destroyed, but luckily, the hair samples that were stated as being a possible match for John ultimately contained the DNA that set him free.
The DA, he didn't, once it came back saying it was 90-something percent, 99 or something like that, he said release him. He didn't care through all those other preliminaries. Once they found out that the DNA came back, not me, I know that the DA in Meriwether County were real cooperative in my release.
According to the Georgia Innocence Project website, on August 2, 2007, the Georgia Innocence Project filed an extraordinary motion for a new trial to test the hairs. After negotiations with the Coucha Circuit District Attorney's Office, a consent order for DNA testing was assigned on November 7, 2007, and the evidence was sent to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation Crime Lab. The GBI completed its tests and released the results on December 6, 2007. The next day, GIP representatives traveled to Macon State Prison to inform Mr. White of his impending release. That same day, the GBI confirmed a cold hit on the Combined DNA Index System, also known as CODIS, revealing that the hairs belonged to another man.
I went home for maybe about 30 minutes because They didn't want me in Meriwether County. They didn't want me in Manchester, my family, nor the Georgia Innocence Project. So they wanted me to come to Atlanta. So when I was released from I went through my hometown, and we went come straight up here to Atlanta, and we had some interviews and things.
I asked what the adjustment was like to freedom after having been incarcerated for so long.
I had problems. I had problems as far as dealing with people outside my family. The media, I didn't have no problem talking to. The only thing I had a problem with was getting emotional. I used to get emotional when I used to talk to the media. People would try to embrace me. If I was in, like, say, for instance, if I was in church, people would come up and try to embrace me, and I would, what would go through my mind was, where was you, why, when I was in the penitentiary? You know, I had a lot of people try to embrace me and show me some type of affection that wasn't shown when I was inside the penitentiary. And I rejected it, and I ran from that.
I asked who was there to help him after he was released.
Well, I had help from the George Jones Project when I got out. But on a daily basis, even X amount of years later, now, I still have problems, you know, dealing with society, because there's a lot of things I didn't mature. I didn't have the opportunity to mature to like the average person. Like relationship failures, disappointments, and things like that. There, so I have issues there. Well, that's the way it, you know, you've been. You know, when you get up in the penitentiary every day, you pretty much on a schedule. You know what pretty much what to do during the course of that whole day. You know, you don't have to worry about nothing. For dictating your life, they're going to dictate it for you. So when you go in there as a young kid and you come out, you know, at the age of 30, 35, sometime maybe 40, you know, you pretty much dealing with life on a kid level, because these things you ain't never experienced. You ain't experienced an argument with a female. You just ain't had the difficulty a normal person would have had those years in his life, and finances, and basically anything I hear now, you know, you have a problem doing it. You have a problem dealing with it. Because you're in the penitentiary, it was an X amount of money you could spend every week. You know, it's all being governed for you. And out here, when something get off track, you know, you ain't on schedule. It's hard. It's hard for you to get back on track.
I wondered what his life was like now, almost 10 years after his release.
I'm struggling to deal with my relationship. I'm struggling to deal with my finances, which I done filed bankruptcy. I'm struggling.
I had talked to John previously, and his friend Clarence was on last week's episode. And they had both expressed an interest in sharing with the listeners a goal in which they are working towards. I asked John if he could share some more information with me, in hopes that it would reach listeners who could connect with them for help.
Georgia don't have a compensation law that forces them to do the right thing for when dealing with someone that have been wrongly convicted. We trying to get a compensation bill passed and have it retroactive. You know, it's a lot of issues I don't think a whole lot of people know about as far as us, I'm talking about us, the exonerees. They don't know what being in that traumatic situation, being in that situation, have done to us. And we want to shed light on it and let the people know that, you know, it's a damage been done in our lives. And we need help. When I got out, you know, thank God for the George Jones Project, because, you know, I would give them the opportunity to seek counseling and a whole lot of other programs that, you know, through donations that were provided for me. You know, our medical, I was provided counseling. And during that course, that counseling, they diagnosed me with post-traumatic stress syndrome, and institutionalization. And it wasn't noticeable back then. You know, it is, 10 years later, you know, and it's just starting to come apparent. And we want these things addressed. We don't want the next person that's getting out that maybe done did 15, 20, whatever amount of years, to have to experience what, you know, we're experiencing 10 years after our getting caught, you know, released. You know, Georgia, I don't think they did us right.
I asked what advice John might have for others who have been wrongfully convicted.
Listen to that little voice. You know, that's all that way I can say. You know, at that point in my life, you know, I guess you, when you get to your lowest point, that's when you, you know, you can hear the voice of God. You know, I'm just going to have to tell you like this. That's when you going to hear. And when you get to that point, you got to listen to that little voice. And if people, whichever direction he tell you to go in, that's whichever way you got to go. And there's people out there that he'll direct you to. That's what I can tell them, you know. I sat down at the Enterprise. I read a lot of letters, the guys that wrote to the project, you know, asking for help and everything like that. And, you know, I responded to a few, but not in that manner. But that's, you know, that's where my help came from.
Then I asked what we could do to help.
You gotta holler louder.
It was kind of funny. I thought John was telling me to speak up because my head was turned away from the microphone when I asked this question. But then I realized that he was telling us to use our voices to be advocates.
I said you gotta holler louder, but so the people can hear. But what you doing now? Just being supportive and help the people that's out there trying to help the guys that's out there, you know, out there trying to help us. I listen to a lot of politics, so that it's hard for me to say what need to be done. I mean, oh God, you know, but we need a legislative voice. That's where the change is gonna have to come. That's where it all happens at. That little gold dome building up there. And it's, you know, if it don't happen there, it's not gonna happen in the state of Georgia. And it's a lot of other states that don't have the proper things in place that help, you know, a guy get back into society once he done been wrong and convicted or something of that nature. And so we need people, you know, lobbying for it, you know, talking to congressmen and senators and whatnot, and getting those votes. We here in the state of Georgia have a lady, she's sponsoring a compensation bill, Ms. Carolyn Huger. And this past legislative term, it failed, you know. We just got to go back next year and, you know, hope we can have enough people behind it.
After we ended the interview, John told me that he and Clarence had been talking that day and they had a request. They needed a platform. They want to gather several exonerees that they are friends with and talk about the reform needed to help people who had been exonerated be successful. They wanted this show to be that platform. I told John that I would do my best to help him out, so I'm hoping to set a date to make a trip to Georgia to meet with this group of exonerees to allow them to share their vision of justice reform with you. I get so many emails every week of people asking me what they can do to help, and that has inspired a new series of Helpers episodes. I will be interviewing people, regular people, just like us, that are helping with social justice reform using the talents that they've been given. Whether it's investigating, acting, or podcasting, I want to help everyone understand that you can help by using the skills you already possess. Look for a special Helpers episode very soon. After the credits, read by Stephanie, a member of my new volunteer team, to be introduced next week, listen for some interview outtakes. you can contact me at actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. So until next time, I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening.
The Actual Innocence Podcast is hosted and produced by Brooke Giddings. The volunteer team is composed of Stephanie Satilli, Meg Delaney, and Sarah Nelson. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. Our logo is designed by Vale Darris, and you can find him on Fiverr.com. And our theme song is by Andy Cohen. Special thanks to our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus and Stamps.com. Please support us by supporting them. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks for listening.
The only thing I had a problem with getting emotional, I used to get emotional when I used to talk to the media. I probably would be getting emotional if I was talking to you face to face.
I'm having a bad hair day. You'd probably be laughing.
No.
What can people like us do to help?
You got to holler louder.
Sorry?
I said I was getting kind of sucky. Yeah, I said you.